Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. I am very proud to have with me Marilyn Robinson, who is here to discuss her novel Home for the second week. As you know, when I talk about a writer or a novelist for several weeks, it's because I think the book and the writer are very special. And I wanted to talk about a quality here that I think perhaps many readers and critics haven't been able to describe or isolate. I was talking to one of my most wonderful friends and a good reader about Gilead after it came out, and he said that he found the book too homely. And I said, no, I think it's, you know, helping us to make distinctions in piety. And that this character is often flawed in complicated ways. And yes, no matter what he says, he's going to sound richly good, but he's prone to jealousy of an extreme sort and retaliation, retaliatory vengefulness for fantasy slights. And my friend said, oh, you're not telling me this is an unreliable narrator now. This is not an unreliable narrator. I said, no. In fact, no, George. I think it's about when someone is striving to be good, that doesn't mean that they necessarily attain it or that they attain it all the time. And I think that these books both put us in a range where we suddenly understand that good is such a relative thing. And in fact, it leads to a climactic place in both books, provoked by Jack, when he essentially says, what about predestination? And everyone has to cough and stutter and wonder how to answer this question. Can someone be preternaturally saved or damned? And what about good works? And what about the hypocrisy of good works, sometimes present even in good people? These all seem to me to be the nuances and carefulnesses that these books examine.
I think that, I mean, certainly that's true. I don't think that anybody ever achieves goodness as any kind of continuous state of being, and that the greatest goodness is perhaps the awareness of one's own failure to be good, you know, the failure to be reliably as one would wish or as one ought to be, you know. Ames is, of course, necessarily in an unreliable situation because he's trying to be a kind of an ideal father to his son through the letters, you know. And so he's trying to be somewhat candid about himself at the same time that what he wants to leave the son is basically the sense of a good father, you know, a good man who is his father and loves him. And as he becomes more obsessed with his present situation, this voice becomes more candid in a sense, more revealing of his jealousies and so on. But I think that any narrator is pretty unreliable, basically. I just think of that as kind of realism, I suppose.
A given of existence?
A given of existence.
Now, the new book, Home, published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux, like the first, although they can be read separately, there's a moment in each of these books where we feel like Jack, who has been away from his family for 20 years. In both books, there's a moment you feel he's the best character in the books, that he seems more diligent, more moral, perhaps because more fallen or because he has more latitudes open to his perception, so that goodness is a choice rather than a habit. And in both books, there are flashes of seeing Jack be good where you find him so admirable, you know. Now, here, this time round, he really does. He's, in a sense, promised to reveal himself as who he is. And he does come home drunk and wrecked, having achieved, it seems, over the shortest imaginable period, a return to disillusion. And suddenly we really do see that the man we had followed with Glory and her point of view into a kind of perfection. In fact, the eyes don't always see clearly. And so Glory is exposed to a brother suddenly that she had stopped anticipating. You know, the black sheep has his blackness, and now she has to see it and go back to her policy, I accept him no matter what. Mm-hmm. That's such a shock in the writing.
Good. Well, you know, in my ventures into Calvinism, one of the things that he says that I think is very interesting is that God's interest in us might be aesthetic, you know, and that I was interested in Jack as by my lights, an aesthetic figure who presents himself, recommends himself, rescues himself unconsciously, basically, but in terms that I would consider to be handsome or beautiful or, you know, rather than falling along the scale of good or bad.
Now, the Ames household is one in which there have been ferocious forefather ministers, mm-hmm. visionaries, and who are powerfully disapproving of a domesticated church that will accept societal mm-hmm. iniquity. That doesn't come up so much in this book. It seems as if these people begin with affirmation that the Reverend Boughton's first word is yes, mm-hmm. a word that he will repeat again and again, as if salvation is a given. Help me.
Well, there were, you know, I have the Boughtons come into the country after the Civil War because there were a lot of very fierce abolitionist Presbyterian pastors that would, you know, you can find plenty of stories about them and very equivalent to the old grandfather in Gilead. But the Boughton family I put sort of outside that struggle and outside that range of memory. It would be a temperamental difference more than anything else. One of the things that I like Reverend Boughton perhaps more than anybody else does, but he's basically built his theology around Jack, you know, the radical forgiveness, the radical non-judgmentalism, the radical grace, you know, he's the father that embraces the prodigal and so on. And so he's always trying to convert what is difficult and painful into something that he can understand as blessing, something to accept, you know, or to embrace. And that's, you know, he's simply lived his theological life around the problem of loving this child who is just utterly and forever alienated from him. And Ames simply has nothing to equivalent in his own experience.
And I wanted to talk to you about the sense aesthetically of symmetry in this novel, with its characters, in its structure, its artfulness in choosing characters that reflect symmetrical possibilities.
For some reason, I find it, I mean, I practically can't write something without making mirror images like that. It just helps me because it seems to me if you make a flat statement, you're wrong, you know? And if you can have it reflected from different sides simultaneously, you can get at something that has a great deal more of a sort of burden of reality about it. I mean, the thing about the man with whom Glory had that kind of non-relationship, he does, I think, sort of make us realize that there were things, there were serious things about the way that Jack has lived and so on, you know, that he's not, I mean, and Glory has to know it too. She has to know that his life has been very injurious in ways that she can really relate to. If she simply had no way of knowing, no way of getting any bearings on what Jack's life has probably been, then it wouldn't mean much for her to forgive him or to be at peace with him in the way she wants to be.
Her sense by the end of the book, she is our animating consciousness in this book, and she's going to have to decide whether the fact that she is likely to be here in this home for the rest of what there is of her life, whether this is a blessing or a sorrow, whether in fact, like Jack, she needs to leave, why it is for Jack she may feel she needs to stay.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, while Jack occupies a center of ground in the book, that decision for its consciousness seems central. She's the one, in a sense, without drama in her life, who has the more complicated issues of acceptance. Where is she at the end of the book?
Well, at the end of the book, she's imagining her own future life, which she has not utterly settled into, but the implication, I think, is that she will. And she's imagining the consequences of Jack's life. And she's, in a way, when she has come to understand, in a way, what home meant seen through his eyes, then she can't help but be loyal to what she has seen, you know.
And to maintain it?
Yes, well, yes. After their fashion, yes.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Marilyn Robinson, author most recently of Home, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. We'll continue after this short break. I I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Marilyn Robinson about her new novel, Home. Now, this is a world that, in a sense, changes before our very eyes. I think it's something that only fiction can do, but I wouldn't want to be, you know, pressed to the wall. But let me give you an example of what I mean. There's a novel called The Man Who Loved Children, and it's been narrated by a young girl describing her house, her family, poverty, the gradual deprivations that are the consequence of alcoholism, things that have been so amusingly rendered that we've sort of resisted considering them abuse. And around the middle of the novel, a school teacher comes to visit, and we see the house through her eyes. The characters are drinking from jars. Everything is dirty. The furniture has all been sold. We'd been thinking we were in a rather fine middle-class house, but time and catastrophe have eroded the place we thought we were. Now, in your book, too, there's suddenly a set of jars when we realize Jack's an alcoholic. His father is not always remorselessly kind. He's remorselessly remorseless. All these things take us and shake us out of the somnolent world we thought we'd been living in.
Yes, well, the house, which was always home to seven children and so on, nevertheless was a sort of scene of pain and sadness for them, because it was only seven children, you know, because the rejection, the absence, and so on. And even when he was a child, the feeling that he stood apart from them. And so the house, it seems to me, is an ambiguous place in forever, you know, from the beginning, at least, of Jack's life. And his father has always sort of tried to convert things into the best interpretation of them. But after a certain point, he can't maintain his faith in that anymore, you know. And I think that as much as anything else is what creates the sense of a changed place.
That and the fact that Jack has come home and now he and Glory are repairing primarily Jack. You know, Glory will warn him that perhaps cutting the trumpet vines on the porch will disorient their father, but Jack kind of needs to clear out the growths. He repairs a car in the garage. He's repairing paths and replanting the mother's iris garden. He's like a principle of restoration until we discover, you know, it's almost he's done that, in fact, for a week or two. Mm-hmm. That narratives conceal the way time passes in them. So just when we've been thinking, well, you know, what a welcome and industrious young man, we suddenly see by the end of the book that the house requires constant upkeep, more than we could reasonably ask for. Mm-hmm. And that if Glory is going to stay, she's going to see only the things that she repairs and keeps up. The rest will be relegated to fictional invisibility, you know, the invisibility of narrowed in consciousness. And what an amazing thing to watch this house sort of spruce up and, you know, become, you know, be cleaning its own feathers. And, you know, and then suddenly we realize, oh, no, that wasn't what was happening. It was just the idea about home that was being animated. And what a lot of incredible work of perception is going on in this book to distinguish the desired, the yearned for, the ideal from the actual, and the pious from the human.
Yeah. Well, ideal of home, the complexity of the word, you know, the fact that it has 100 different emotional valences and so on. That was very much on my mind writing about it, you know, how it can be reassuring and painful and excluding and including and all these kinds of things. And how, in a way, it gives, again, the sense of the kind of wholeness and continuity, even if the idea of home is moved to another place, you know, what you take are the habits, the expectations that you learn to love somewhere else, in some place that you thought of or experienced, you know, as home. It's an interesting thing, you know. The question about Jack's goodness. One of the figures in my mind while I was writing this is the thief on the cross, the thief who. You know, I mean, you imagine these people utterly in extremis, in the worst possible circumstances, you know. And one of the thieves taunts Jesus. And the other thief says, he's an innocent man. What are you doing? You know. And the idea that someone at that extreme of misery would care that the man beside him was being taunted, would care to defend his innocence, you know. And that's taken many times in Christian tradition to mean, this was the thief, you know, that triggered the benign response, and this is the thief that went the way of, you know. But if you think, again, of Jesus' response as aesthetic, you know, this man has done a beautiful thing, you know. The idea of being able to perceive someone acting beautifully within the limits of their humanity, mm-hmm. it seems to me very, very important. And, you know, one of the things that Jack is doing is hoping that he can make his home a place that perhaps his own son could see as a home, you know, that would not seem intimidating and would not seem, you know, and that in a certain sense would fuse his childhood memory with the child's memory and so on, you know. I think of that as a lovely impulse, having to do again with what I was talking about the transmission of things, you know.
Well, also, it seems to me that a thief and an alcoholic can be a moral man.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, the 100 reasons that we give, whether biology or temptation, don't stop someone. Someone can be helplessly alcoholic or helplessly a thief, but they can also be helplessly pious.
You know,
it seems to me that's Jack too, that he was raised in a certain way, and that way has included, during the 20 years he's been away from home, knowing the Bible still better and better,
mm-hmm.
almost as if searching for an explanation of his other helplessness.
Exactly, yes, absolutely. And, you know, I mean, he lies, and then but he's continuously aware that he does, so he's always modifying or correcting against, which I think in a way makes him more honest than people who are not aware that they probably have the same problem, you know, that they, in one way or another, probably lie too.
And he seems to know that in his history of seductions, that he has treated other women to the same charms that he's now treating his sister to.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a quality there of not wanting to fool her, of ultimately going off the wagon, as they say, so that she won't have illusions about him, in part. I mean, that may be a very dexterous and complicated excuse, but it seems like it's part of his truth, too. Don't saint me too quickly.
Exactly. This is your brother Jack without his disguise.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. I just, but I was conscious, partly because of the way that some people did respond to him in Gilead, or responded to John Ames for that matter. I really do think that these questions of, you know, when talking about goodness, you're talking about worth, in effect, you know, and that an idea of goodness that excludes value and worth, it becomes something other than goodness, you know. And so I was very conscious of that, trying to just complicate that idea.
Well, I think also, I might be wrong, but it seems to me that you couldn't have known that the sweetness and beauty, the dulcet quality of the language in Gilead would blind people to the world and the complexities it was trying to describe. This book seems to be about making sure that the reader will penetrate the glories of incidental notation to see the nature of the world and its complexity.
I certainly would. That would make me very happy, yes.
I've been talking with Marilyn Robinson, author most recently of Home, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Thank you, Marilyn, again for joining me.
Pleasure. You're a great interviewer. You're famous all over the country.
It's out of devotion.
Where else could it come from?
You can read an excerpt from Home at kcrw.com/bookworm. You can podcast this program, share it with a friend, or embed it on your blog with a click of a button on our new media player at kcrw.com. My co-producer is Melinda Siegel. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time. To the jungles you can go in.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones from our website. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm. Plus, copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.